cultural aspects of marriage in the ancient world. And I have already suggested the importance that this has this through biblical studies, and also to give us a perspective on marriage today. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we want to get to the practical section, which everybody, that's why y'all took the course. Y'all didn't take the course for this part, right? I'd like to know where I stand. I'm on page, middle of page 7 on our syllabus. In Rome, by the time of Augustus, which is the New Testament age, New Testament period, the legal minimum age for marriage for girls was set at 12, for boys at 14. I've already talked about these early ages. A study of 145 inscriptions, I indicate here, revealed that more than half of the wives, who were mainly from the upper middle class, were married by age 15. Since dowries were expected, wealthy girls were married earlier than poorer girls. A girl who was not yet married at 19 was considered an old maid. By 19. Anxious parents would often increase the dowries and publicize this fact to attract suitors. Grooms were generally men in their 20s with an average age of 25. So the girls who were not married yet, they could, if you hold off till you were about 25, you'd probably get a girl with more money thrown in than if you take one of the picked one at an earlier age. This was a real problem in the ancient world. My favorite story about this, and this is degrading to women, but in the ancient world, girls were kind of, not really in a sense, sold. The dowry was that, but it amounted to almost selling the daughter. In Rome. My favorite story in the ancient world was back long before the Roman period. In Herodotus, this is in the syllabus, Herodotus, in his histories, tells about the Babylonian bride market. He said in these Babylon, and I don't know if this is true or not, you don't trust Herodotus because it's such a great story that he would tell it even if he thought it was false, because he had to choose between passing by a good story and telling the truth. He would tell the story. And then he'd say, well, you can make up your own mind about this. He didn't add that qualification to this story. But in the Babylonian bride market, Herodotus, maybe you may have read this, that they would start out, in order to get everybody married in these Babylonian towns, they would, on a certain day, they would have a bride market. They would all bring all the marriageable young women in, and they would start with the most desirable. Now, what was desirable to them is not desirable to Americans, modern Americans. The average modern girl, they would consider her kind of a useless, skinny old thing. Wouldn't be worth much. But anyway, what they would do is they'd start out at one end with the prettiest or the most desirable, and they would sort of auction her off. Who would pay the most? It would go to the father, of the bride, to recompense her for his loss. And in the Roman period, it went to the groom. Anyway, they would auction her off, and they would put this money aside, and then take the second most desirable and auction her off a little bit less for her. And they would go out down the line until they sort of struck even, until they got, nobody was bidding. Then they'd start on the other end, get the least desirable young woman, the ugliest. And they'd say, now, who'll take the least for taking her? Then they'd take the money that from the most desirable and pay men to take the ugly one. See? In other words, men had to pay to get the more desirable ones, but they would pay men to take the ugly one. And then they'd auction her off. It would be a reverse auction. Who would take the least money? The guys, they'd hold fire until they keep up in the ante. And finally, somebody said, I'll take her for that. And so he would get money, and then they would take the second least desirable, and they would auction her off, and the guy would get a little bit less for taking her, and then right on down, so they'd take the money that they got for the best ones, and use it to bribe fellas to take the others. So at the end, all the money was gone and everybody had a wife. I told you it was degrading. But now you got to look at it. See what it did. Now, it worked. Everybody got married. Everybody got a wife. Every woman got a husband. And anyway. Now, see what a guy could do, though. Now, there's certain wisdom in this. You all got to appreciate the ancients. Certain wisdom. See what a guy could do. If a guy was broke and needed some money, or he wanted to add to his farm, he could decide whether to have a good-looking woman or 40 acres. See? See? And he got a wife who might be a good worker, and money to boot. And but see, the guy on the other end of the spectrum who started first, not only did he not get any money, it cost him. Well, that made for a good marriage. He could always say to his wife, look, I could have, you know, ugly Sal and 40 acres, and I took you and paid $400. Well, you better treat me right. Anyway, I think you're probably right. Aren't you glad we don't do it that way now? But that was he told it for the straight truth. Yes.
Are dowry more important than the letting a man of the issue? Was how much you were going to get the money wise?
Mm-hmm.
That was what really was,
yes,
most important rather than what she looked like.
Well, you see, it depends on not just that, not what she looked like. Her family connections, did she have any land? Was she in for an inheritance? Did her family have a history of children who lived would be important to her. It wasn't just looks. It was a whole number of considerations. Romans tried to marry into good families, be girls from good families, come into inheritances, that kind of thing.
So that was more important
than whether or not they were. Yes. That was as important to them as her, how she looked and her personality. Because he was going to have somebody on the side anyway. It's disgusting, isn't it? Really? Well, I think you ought to know this, that the Jewish view, that's a very low view of women. The Roman view was a very low view of women. And it was higher than the average in the ancient world. The Jewish view was higher than the average pagan view in the first century. But it was the church that elevated women, that gave dignity to women. That treated women. For instance, in Christ, there's neither male nor female. Women find real dignity in Christianity. Well, anyway, in early Rome, in the early history of Rome, fathers exercised absolute authority over their children as long as they lived. It was called patria potestas, which means the power or the authority of the father in Latin. We the word potestas means, you know, we have our word potential, something has capacity, it's a cognate to that word. And as long as the children, fathers exercised absolute authority over their children as long as they lived, and females were always under a man's potestas or tutelage. That is, a woman had to be sponsored by a man, just as in Greek culture, maybe an uncle or a brother. That is, for instance, a woman could not take a matter to court on her own. A man had to take it for her, to sponsor her. A woman could not enter into a contract on her own. A man would have to sponsor her, use her father or brother, father-in-law. Fathers sometimes married off daughters without consulting their wives. In the late Republic, however, as I know, women became more and more liberated. Now, let me speak. I teach you this not to entertain you or to bore you, but to give you a perspective. You see, there were two views of the home in the ancient world, well, by the first century, that are important to us. One was the Greek view, and one was the Roman view. In the Greek view in Greek life, and as you know, the Greek society never didn't work very well. Great ideas. But the Greeks never built a great empire. Alexander the Great's empire was his, and it was not Greek, it was Hellenistic. The Greek democracy didn't last very long. One of the reasons was that the Greek culture was inherently weak for all kinds of reasons. geography played a part in their city-state system. But one of the things that made Greek life inherently weak, and they would never have admitted this, is that the fundamental unit in Greek life was the city, or the state. We would call it the state in the genetic sense. That is, children belong primarily to the state. It was the state's responsibility to educate them. They were to be raised, to be educated, to be functioning members of society, which is exactly the theory in America, in the West. Now, the Roman view was that children belonged to the father. Everything belonged to him. The power of the father, patria potestas. Under Roman law, a father had the right to put his children to death anytime he wanted to, as long as he lived. If he were 60 and his son or daughter was 45, he could still put him to death in the state. Now, it didn't happen very often, but they had that authority. And with it, we're going to talk about this when we come to the principle of the hierarchy. We mentioned it, perhaps, I forget. We haven't yet, no. But you see, with that authority came responsibility. And so it was the responsibility of the father to raise the children. Now, he didn't do it all. The Roman slogan was, at the mother's knee and at the father's side. A boy was trained at his mother's knee until he got to a certain age, at his father's side. Now, his father wouldn't do all the training, but he'd direct, whereas in Greek culture, in the Greek ideal, back in the classical period, the age of Pericles, the state oversaw the education of the child. In this case, in the Roman law, the father oversaw the education of the child, and it was done primarily through apprenticeships. Romans says his father, the old days of the Republic, the father, as soon as the child got old enough to get away, be away from the mother, the father would put him under as an apprentice to a teacher, hire a teacher that often hired Greeks as teachers, interestingly enough. And later on, they adopted the Greek view as the empire crumbled, disintegrated. But he had to learn, but there was a very practical approach to education. That is, whereas the Greeks, they said a man's not educated until he can learn, until he knows poetry, the theater, music. The Romans didn't like that. The Greeks considered the Romans to be barbarians, a bunch of hillbillies. The Romans said that all that learning is no good. They wanted a boy who knew his math, and he could build things, who knew how to make the farm work, who knew how to make the government work, and so he would work beside his father on the farm, learn how it went. But his learning was strictly pragmatic. The Romans never wrote much poetry, and the poetry they did write was copied from the Greeks. For instance, the great piece, the Aeneid, Virgil's Aeneid, is copied. Is simply a Roman version, of course, of Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey and that genre of literature. So, but the Romans were very practical, and the girl would learn the practical, what we call the domestic arts, how to run a home. And Roman women became very good at running homes. They would run whole complexes of homes. The rich would have several homes, and they would run, and they would have slaves under them, become pretty good administrators. They weren't just barefoot and pregnant. But the boys would learn their business. They would learn to read and write for the purpose of doing business and for the purpose of conducting government. They learned government by going with their father to the Senate, to the various legislative bodies, sitting and listening. Their father, every Roman man had a military obligation to the officers, and so a man would either take his son beside him on his stint of military duty and teach him how to run a legion, or he would put him under a general, which was very often the case. A friend, he served an apprenticeship. As a result, a Roman boy had a very practical education. The Greeks didn't. That's one of the reasons why nobody could stand against the Roman army. There have been many books written about why Rome fell, not very many written about why it rose. How did this little Italian city-state, that had very few natural resources, didn't have a lot going for it, how did it come to rule the world for so long? The answer, the reason it grew so fast was that the Romans were very practical people. As the old saying was, Greeks for brains and Romans for drains. Well, that's a very practical thing in the ancient world when most people, a lot of people died of typhoid because of bad drains. And there are Roman roads and bridges that are still being used in the world, not very many. The Romans knew how to make a government work. They knew how to build a bridge that would stand up, a road that would last. They knew how to administer other countries and knew how to fight. One of the reasons that Rome was hard to defeat in battle was that in the early days, the rank and file were Roman citizens. Now later on they were not. They were foreigners and slaves, but later on they were risen on their Roman citizens, and these were boys who had been raised to do what they were told. It's amazing what you can do if you get a bunch of people to do what they're told. They were easily regimented. They were raised to obey and to work together. And so when it came to logistics, and as you know, the art of war really is the art of engineering. Wars are won or lost by the skill of the engineers, if you knew that or not. Not sharpshooters, engineers. For instance, as you know, a degree from West Point is an engineering degree. Did you know that? We have a graduate here, Jim. His degree, I would guess, is an engineering degree. Now, and what this said was that what this meant. Well, what does that say to us? Well, it's interesting. This is very close to the biblical idea with the pagan elements taken out. In that we're going to come later, and I'll just introduce it here, looking at it from this historical perspective, that the Roman, that the biblical doctrine is, in a sense, patria potestas, that the father is the head of the house, bearing the primary responsibility, not just the authority. Well, we're going to talk about that. We're going to expand on the fact and discuss the fact that real trouble comes in the Christian home when you have a father who wants the authority but will not take the responsibility. But the Roman father had the responsibility. Now, interestingly enough, for instance, in Colossians where it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord. The word there for children, the Greek, is not little child, babies. It simply means offspring. Honor your parents. The children were to honor, in the biblical concept, children are to honor their parents to, as long as they live, and to obey them as long as they are in the home, and no matter what the age. You understand? It says offspring, honor your parents. So if you're a man who's 40 and his parents are 65, he is under the obligation to honor his parents just as much as a 10-year-old is his parents. And to obey as long as they're in the home. That's the biblical mandate, as I understand it. You understand? It doesn't say little babies honor your parents. It's offspring honor their parents. Which is very close, you see, to the Roman concept. With some important differences. Now, this works very well, but this system, let me teach you something here, a principle, just so I get into philosophy a little bit. This system of authority, where you have an authority figure in the home. Now, this view, which, when we come to this, I'm going to teach a view of the home which is considered heresy, is considered obscene by modern psychologists, the modern humanists. They would string me up if they could. It's considered extreme even by some Christians. I recently read through some manuscripts of the North American Christian Convention on the home, and they labeled my view Calvinistic. Can you imagine me being called a Calvinist? And authoritarian is the favorite word for it. But I point, when we come to it, I will defend my view primarily what the Scriptures teach. We must do what the Bible says. But secondly, as the most common sense approach, you see, the problem is not between authoritarianism or non-authoritarianism. But as a matter of fact, somebody's always in charge. There is always an authority. Whether it's the wife or the husband or the kids or the goldfish. I was preaching in Winter Park, preached on the family Wednesday night, and I made this statement. It's true that in the 50s, where I grew up, the fathers were the heads of the house. In the 60s, the men decided they didn't want the responsibility, they gave it to the women. In the 70s, the women decided they didn't want it, gave it to the children. And now nobody's in charge in many homes. Absolute chaos. I was in a home in Florida 2-3 years ago. I'm not making this up. The dog was in charge. You see, whoever's will prevails. When there's a conflict of wills, whoever's will prevails heads the house. And this is how this couple had retired. They loved to travel. And they had retired and bought a motorhome with the view of retiring. They found out after they retired and got ready to start traveling that their dog, Jiffy or whatever, some stupid little poodle or some artificial dog, didn't like to travel, and so they stayed home. They sat in their living room and watched their motorhome rust in the driveway because Jiffy didn't like to travel. And it's all I could do to keep them vomiting in the first place. And I really took a physical effort for me not to say, why don't you drop kick Jiffy into the next county and take charge of your own life? Of course, I grew up on a farm. And farm boys have a certain view of animals. But I tell you, the very idea of a grown man who's an elder in the church sitting there saying, boy, I sure wish I could travel, but my dog doesn't want to. And therefore, sitting home, the thought was, frankly, literally, almost more than I could take. I've seen, there are all kinds of homes run by 8-year-old kids, but it's run by a dog. I just picture that guy asking the permission of the goldfish to go out for the evening or something. It's absurd. Well, so my point is, somebody's in charge. If you want to see something authoritarian in a home, you look at a spoiled 8-year-old kid. Now that's an authoritarian. That's an example of authoritarian. You see, the question is not, do we have authority or do we do not have authority? That's a very false dichotomy. The question is, who has the authority? And the problem comes in, what I'm trying to teach you now, looking from the perspective of the Roman view, patria potestas, the problem comes in, not, the issue is not, the problem area or the debate is not whether we have an authority or not. You always have one. The question comes in, is it a properly constituted authority, and is it a responsible authority? That does the person in charge know his business or her business? Are they doing a good job? That's the issue. That's true in government or anything else. No program is any better than its leaders. And no home is any better than who is in charge. But somebody's always in charge. Now, so this was not an intrinsically evil system. It simply depended upon who was in charge. And look at the next statement I make. These customs seem stern, but we must not conclude that there was not widespread tenderness, love, and understanding. Classical Roman literature abounds with examples of tender family love. Now, the family situation, as it has in America, broke down as Rome got into the days of the empire and things began to fall apart. But the average Roman father, back in the golden days of the Republic, and even into the empire period, he was not a tyrant who went around threatening death to his children. You just read the literature of the period, and it rings true to our ears. They were a good family. That is, Roman families tended to be good families. One of the reasons Rome grew. I'll give this example of marriage arrangements, and I'm not going to read this, all of this. Maybe I will. Well, here's an example of an arrangement being made for a marriage. I cite the source. It's one of Pliny's letters. And let's follow along as I read this to get the feel of, here's a Roman marriage arrangement. Gaius Plinius to his dear Junius Maricus, Maricus, we would say. Sounds like Paul, doesn't it? You know, that's how. You request me to look for a husband for your niece, and it is fitting for you to give me this commission rather than to anyone else, for you know how much I esteemed and loved that great man, her father, and with what encouragement he helped me in my youth. Now he caused me to appear to deserve the praises he used to bestow upon me. You could not give me a more important or more pleasant commission, nor could I undertake a more honorable task than to choose a young man worthy of begetting the grandchildren of Rusticus Arulanus. Such a person would take a long time to find. And he goes on, he's saying, I'm honored to get this job. He says, I found just the man, Minucius Acilianus, Onesius, our Cyrenian, is ready to hand. So he said, as luck would have it, I got just the young man handing. He's around. Almost as if by prearrangement. Fate, kismet. I love this. Now, whether this guy was all this good, probably not, but he's pushing him. While he loves me very warmly, with the affection usual between young men, for he is just a few years younger, he reveres me as he would an old man, for he is as desirous of modeling himself on me and of being instructed by me as I was by you and your brother. That is, he likes me. He can't be all bad. I love it. He wants to imitate me, so it shows how smart he is and what a worthy catch he would be. He's from Brixia, native of Brixia, city of Italy, of that Italy of ours, the Italy which still retains and preserves much of the modesty. He comes from a town that's still traditional. His father is he names his father, one of the leading men of the equestrian order. That means he was sort of upper middle class. He wasn't an aristocrat. Who desired no higher status, for though elevated to Praetorian rank by the deified Vespasian, he's the one that destroyed Jerusalem. He still very steadfastly preferred an honorable repose to this display, and so forth. Well, you can read that. Look at the last paragraph. I don't know whether to add that his father is very rich. Of course you add that. That's it. That's what you call tact. He says, I don't know if I should mention that his daddy's got big bucks, but I'll just throw that in. Well, you can see, here's an example of a man being commissioned to find a husband for a friend. And he did it. Now, what does she think about all this? It doesn't say. But would she be considered? Yes. We're talking about the Roman home. I put in an excerpt from a strange source. Rudyard Kipling, in his series Puck of Pook's Hill, which is not a child series, a series of short stories, in which in this series, Kipling really knew his Roman history. And in his series, he predates or anticipates Michener. You know, Michener, his style of writing is he'll pick out a location and then he'll go back in time, and it's like tearing away the levels of time, and he'll start the prehistoric period and go right up to the modern period, all the stories centering in a place, like the Well at Macor from the source, and Chesapeake is Chesapeake Bay, and what's the series that was on television, Colorado, Centennial. Anyway, but what Kipling did was he took a site there called Pevensey. Pevensey, it's on South England, looking over toward France, across the English Channel. And he tells a series of stories about this place going way back in a very ingenious way. But he goes back to the Roman period. And what he has is the children in the series. Have you ever read this series by Kipling? It's in a book. Two children, English children, modern English children, well, modern Victorian, modern in his day, Victorian, in the Victorian age, are out playing, and they're putting on a shortened version of they're playing Shakespeare, and their father has written an abridged form of one of Shakespeare's plays, Midsummer Night's Dream. Lo and behold, they accidentally say magic words that, as they say, break the hills among the little people, the old people of England, the elves, and Puck comes out. They were singing a fairy ring, saying this, and they said just the right words, and the magic words. Anyway, so Puck comes out and he brings to see them people from the past, and they tell the story of that of Pevensey. And one of the peoples he brings was a Roman centurion. And he tells them how it was in his day, when it was Roman Britain. Anyway, that's the background of it. We need to get into that much in the background. But he's telling about his growing up in a Roman home. And I put this in because, in my opinion, it really captures the spirit of a good Roman home. He tells the children, good families are very much alike. Mother would sit spinning of evenings while Aglaia, she was the Greek governess, Greek slave, was a governess. Aglaia read in her corner, father did accounts, and we four, Eunice's brothers and sisters, romped about the passages, the hallways. When our noise grew too loud, the pater would say, "Less tumult, less tumult. Have you never heard of a father's right over his children?" There's his father, you know. Keep it down, kids. "He can slay them, my love. Slay them dead, and the gods highly approve of the action." You kids, knock it off. Don't you know that I have a right to put you to death? Then mother would prim up her dear mouth over the wheel and answer, "I'm afraid there can't be much of the Roman father about you." Then pater would roll up his accounts and say, "I'll show you." And then he'd be worse than any of us. As he'd join them. He just threatened them with death. He'd join them and play with them. "Fathers can, if they like," said Una. She's the one of the little English children who broke the spell. "Fathers can, if they like," said Una, her eyes dancing. "Didn't I say all good families are very much the same?" "Fathers can do that," she said. Fathers can if they like. Is the delight. Here you see Kipling captures two things. He captures this good Roman father, who, although he has the power of death legally over his children, and he kids them about it, they know they're safe. And he rolls up his accounts and joins them romping about the passages. And Una, the modern girl, her eyes dance, and she's delighted. Why? Because she's got a father that does the same thing. She says, "Yeah, I know." And blessed in any age is the child, especially little girls, who have a parent, especially a father, who will roll up the accounts and get down on his hands and knees and pray. Well, we're going to talk more about that later in the practical section. But we must not conclude that the Roman system was a systematically, universally cruel one. It was not. Any questions on that? Well, we come to the Old Testament, and this is sort of a capsulized study I put in the syllabus. In the Old Testament, no minimum age is stated as desirable for marriage, and alma, that's the Hebrew word. This is important. This becomes theologically important. In Isaiah 7:14, you studied this under Dr. Smith, I'm sure. "A virgin shall be with child." The Hebrew word is alma. I write the Hebrew in the syllabus for you. She was a nubile adolescent girl of marriageable age. Did alma mean virgin? The answer is not necessarily. It meant a woman of marriageable age, of that age. Marriage was arranged by parents. A mother could play the role, and I give citations in Genesis where the mother did, but a father could act alone. And we don't take time to read these, but we have citations in Genesis where the father acted alone. Although it was not essential, the bride's consent was at times asked for. Romance was involved in some of the matches. We have accounts where romance was involved. I didn't bring my. Somebody read Judges 14, 1 through 3. I didn't bring my Bible with me. That's at my desk. Come on. Judges 1, 4 through 3. I'm sorry, 14, 1 through 3. You got it? How can you read that little print?
"After Samson went down to Timnah and saw the woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistine. So he came back and told his father and mother, 'I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistine. Now therefore, get her for me as a wife.' Then his father and his mother said to him, 'Is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives, or among all the people, that you go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistine?' But Samson said to his father, 'Get her for me, for she looks good to me.'"
Yeah. Sounds modern, doesn't it? "She looks good. I want her." Romance, or perhaps lust, but at least it was. He says, note this, why didn't he just get her? Those families had to arrange the wedding. He said, "I found somebody I like." Somebody read 1 Samuel 18:20. Anybody got it? Anybody?
Now Michael, Saul's daughter, loved David, and they told Saul that they would be agreeable to him.
Saul and his daughter loved David. So romance was involved. When we think of the arranged marriages in the Old Testament, we must not think that every daughter was brought kicking and screaming into a marriage that her parents had arranged without consulting her, or sons the same way. That was not true. You see, it's one thing to like in the case of the Roman system, it's one thing to talk about what the law is and what the tradition or the custom is. But you see, that was simply the framework. Within that, the limitations of that, all kinds of communication went on, all kinds of arrangements were made. Girls would go to their fathers and say, "Daddy, I saw this guy, and how about working things out for me?" Now, in the modern period, she would just come home probably and announce, "Father, I found a man, I'm going to marry him." But you understand, even though they had to be arranged, often in a very modern kind of way, men would see women that they wanted and ask and get the ball rolling, and the other way around. So it's not all that unusual. We see a cognateness in human activity. That is, these general things tend to be present in the human family. I saw a hand. Yes?
You mean, didn't you say, though, that in some cases, even with the Old Testament, marriages were arranged at birth?
Yes.
In some cases. Is that more for political reasons than the common person?
Well, not that would be more the common person. That would be somebody wanted to make sure some land stayed in the family. Somebody wanted to just had a good friend. Two men, good friends. One has a daughter, one has a son. Maybe some money would change hands. Some deals made. Look, he says, look. Then things like this went on. A guy would say, you know that field you've been wanting to buy from me? You've been asking me to sell to you for so long. Let's talk a deal. Look, I'll sell you. I got my wife's had my wife just had another girl, and so I'll tell you what. And your oldest son, you know, maybe 7 or 8. Let's drop a contract so that your oldest son will marry my second girl, and I'll sell you this piece of ground. All kinds of things. See what I'm saying? So that's the kind of thing that happened. And that was not considered cruel, or that was considered good business, normal. We just don't do it that way. But that was, and it worked. Nobody thought it was immoral. They would, this thing of arranged marriages, we're going to talk later about the art of falling in love after the wedding, but that really worked. I was delivering this series on the home 2 or 3 years ago at Sanford, and one of the fellows up there told me this story of his family, which was a true story. It's about his grandmother, who was Jewish, I think, was from Poland or Czechoslovakia, one of the Slavic countries, and his parents came to him and said, "We've arranged. It's time for you to get married. We've made some arrangements." He said, "When we boiled it down to 2 girls, and he gave them the names, he knew who they were, didn't know them that well, they knew who they were, and said, we decide you can take either one. You make the choice between these two. We've talked to both families, and it's whoever you decide. We couldn't make up our mind between the two, but you make up your mind." Well, he couldn't make up his mind. So the day came, we had to go get his wife. He had a horse and a cart, and he's riding down the street or down the road, and as it worked out, there was a fork in the road, and one of the girls lived down this way and the other lived down this way, and so he didn't know what to do, so he just let go of the reins of the horse beside him. Whichever way the horse went, this is the truth, whichever way the horse went, that's who he would go. So he just, you know, I don't know if he prayed or not, you know, and the horse, I don't know which way the horse went. That's who he married, and had a great marriage, and raised a whole household of kids. And this woman who was picked by the horse was this fellow's grandmother. So they met and had a good marriage. We'll come back to this later, the art of falling in love after the wedding. Now, Any questions on that? You get the picture? So it's not the modern free, there was not in the Old Testament marriage customs, the kind of freedom that young people have today. But it was not always just a cut and dried, sterile, oppressive system that we often think of when we talk about arranged marriages. Nor was it with the Roman period. Okay, the New Testament includes no explicit reference to minimum ages for marriage. This is a possible interpretation of 1 Corinthians 7:13 is that this text concerns a father who is anxious about his daughter who is huperachmas, past the flower of her age. Somebody read 1 Corinthians 7:36. So we see what we're talking about here.
If any man thinks to be exacting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter, if she should be of full age, and must be so, let him do what he wishes, he does not stand, let her marry.
Okay. She is what? How's it translated? She is what? Of what age?
Full age.
Full age. That's this word I put in the syllabus. Full age. Huperachmas. Huper is the prefix, as you know in Greek, or may not know. It means the extreme, like hyperbole, beyond. Now, the word virgin is used. In the context, Paul is talking about what men should do with their virgins. It means virgin daughters. What was happening in the church at Rome was, church at Corinth was, and the context is the present distress. He's telling some to stay single because of the present distress, the unsettled conditions. And the issue here is men who are saying, the question is, well, I got my daughter and she's of age, should I arrange a marriage for my daughter now? See, it's one thing for a man to say, I will not take a wife now for the present distress till things settle down, go ahead and have a nice home life, a regular uninterrupted home life. But here's a man who has a daughter. Does he have an obligation to go ahead and arrange a wedding, or should he have put it off? And read the text again so you now listen to what he's saying. You can read it.
If any man thinks to be exacting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter, if she should be of full age, and if he does, and if it must be so, let him do what he wishes. If he does not sin, let him marry.
Yeah, you got that? And he's saying, if a man says, look, I know that what the church is doing now is we're putting off weddings, marriages, because of the present distress, persecution by the Jews and the Romans, or in trouble with the Romans. He says, look, you got a daughter and she's at the age where you don't want to wait any longer, then use your own judgment. Go ahead and arrange a wedding for her, a marriage for her. It's not a sin. He said it's not very smart, but it's not a sin. It's not very wise right now. It's not a sin. Yes. That he's okay. That's a poor translation. It means that he's not doing his duty by her. He's not. That is, he would be. See, if a father had a daughter got to a certain age, and he had not made an attempt to arrange a wedding for her, he would be looked down upon. It would be said he's acting unbecoming toward her. He's not doing his duty. He's not meeting his fatherly responsibilities. Here's the issue. He's a Christian man, and that was considered by the community. It was considered by the pagans to be a dishonorable thing. There's a man who should be working out a marriage for his daughter, hasn't done it. And they were putting this off because of the problems of the stress that was on the church because of persecution. What Paul is saying is, look, if you really think that you're not doing your duty, doing the honorable thing by your daughter, and she's at the age where you just don't want to wait any longer, go ahead. It's not a sin. And go ahead and arrange a wedding for her. Do you understand that, David? Any other questions? Okay, let's take our break. Early Christians followed the Roman precedent in accepting 12 as the minimum legal age for girls and 14 for boys. The minimum age. Laurie, you asked a question about our text in Corinthians about the virgin daughter. She was probably nearing 17 or 18 years old. If a girl got to that age and an arrangement had not been made, it was considered not respectable. The study by Hopkins of 180 Christian inscriptions revealed that the mortal age, that's just the medium age, of Christian brides was 15 to 18 compared to the mortal age of pagan brides from 12 to 15. Interesting that Christians, when the church started in the first century, in the early centuries, that one of the effects of Christianity was it raised the medium age, the average age, for men arranging marriages or marriages taking place. That is the bride's age. Why? Well, Christian parents selected the groom. And although the daughter had a right to refuse the groom or even refuse to marry, got that? The Christians gave more freedom. The Christians allowed their daughters to reject the arrangement. Now, somebody tell me why the age would go up. I've given you one. You understand that the girls, Christian, when they became Christians, they had the right. The marriages were still arranged, but the girls had the right both to refuse a particular husband and to refuse to marry at all. And many did refuse to marry and devoted their full time to the church. But somebody give me another reason why the average age would go up.
Until they got married.
Why would the girls tend to get married older? Notice it. The average is 15 to 18 compared to 12 to 15. Pardon? Yeah, you probably had that. That's right. You see. The pool was decreased. That is, that Christians only marry Christians. And the availability of husbands, therefore, as there were fewer husbands to choose from, because Christians only married Christians, and the persecution increased that because a lot of men died, were put to death. Some of the best Christians, the best men, were put to death or imprisoned or exiled, and so it was harder to arrange marriages. And by the way. Now, later on, this broke down, that sometimes Christians would marry pagans, but as they do today. But in the earliest, in the apostolic church, it was only in the Lord was the principle. Well, do you appreciate the significance of the first point, the first factor, and that is that girls didn't have to go through. They had more say if they were Christians than the pagan girls about who they were going to marry or if they were going to marry. Well, that ends that section. We come now to about the arrangement, the age, and so forth. We come now to betrothal, engagement, and the gifts. And again, this is interesting. It's not exciting. We've talked about these different bride gifts or dowries. They're called various things, bride prices. And in various cultures, they went both ways, and sometimes both ways at the same time. That is, money would be paid to both the bride's family and the groom's family, not very often. In Mesopotamia, this is the Old Testament world, the patriarchal world, I should say, the betrothal was affected by the presentation of appropriate gifts. The violation of a betrothed maiden was considered a capital offense, as she was legally considered a wife. It's interesting, the word wife was used, these betrothals would be made often several years before the wedding, but she was still called a wife, same word. And we see something like this, of course, we'll come to this later, in the arrangement between Mary and Joseph. Now, I give you a citation from the Code of Hammurabi. Remember that? From Western Civ 1? It says, if a citizen has forced a citizen's wife who is not known a man and is laying in her bosom and they seize him, that man shall be put to death. The wife shall go free. This is rape. If a man rapes, note the language. If a man rapes a citizen's wife who is not known a man, who's a virgin, well, how can she be a wife and be a virgin? Well, the answer is, it was a betrothal. That was his wife, even though he was not old enough. The citizen here may just be 10 years old or 12 years old. And the bride, the woman, 12 or 14 years old. But the wedding hasn't taken place yet. Still, that's his wife. And so, now note this, rape did not bring a death penalty. It brought a penalty, but not a death penalty, if she was not engaged to anybody or betrothed. That's interesting. That shows the force of, now what we see with Joseph, we see the force of this betrothal when he and Mary were not married yet, but he would have had to divorce her. Put her away, which is the common Hebrew Greek idiom for divorce. Let me say this to you, in looking at this historically. You all live in an age when an engagement does not bear the force of a contract. But it has in Western civilization tradition to very recent times, it has borne the force of a contract, and it's still on the law, on the books in most states, perhaps all the states. It's called, where if you break the engagement, you are subject to legal penalty. It's called breach of promise. Ever heard of that phrase, breach of promise? In some states it still is. Why would you ask? You were? Yes. By whom? I mean, the groom, or the man or the parents? For the man?
Because
legally, he has. If the balls are still in the books, he could have taken it to court. But it isn't done anymore. It isn't done. And it may be because judges quit enforcing it. I'll tell you why. Because of the breach of promise, usually those laws were written to protect women primarily. Because it would keep a man from taking advantage of a woman and then dropping her. If he agreed to marry her, then if he broke that agreement and that they were officially engaged, she could sue him for breach of promise. Now, it went the other way, but they were designed primarily to protect women because women were being really treated badly. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but what I'm saying is that it's still on the books that an engagement has the force of contract in most states. I don't know. Anybody know what the laws are in Florida, for instance? But you don't hear much of it anymore. It may be because the judges quit enforcing it that nobody takes it to court. I don't know.
I think the law down here says that the bride's father has to make restitution.
No, it doesn't. Well, the betrothal was sealed by the transfer of the terhatu, the bride price, from the groom to the father of the bride, indicating that the bride had value to the father, she could work for him. Therefore, when he took a woman from her father, he had to recompense the father. In the old Babylonian period, this averaged 10 shekels. A shekel was a month's wage. Now you think about that. That's a chunk of money. A large chunk of money. You'd take a mortgage on the house to get a wife in those days, to pay the bride's father. Now the sherektu, the dowry, was given by the father of the bride to his daughter. So the daughter would bring money with her into the marriage from the father. From the old Babylonian period, the dowry was commonly larger than the bride price. Interesting. So you got a lot of that back. Why the dowry? Well, what was the reason for the dowry? Well, in the case of a divorce, the wife could take her dowry with her if she were blameless. Now, the Mesopotamians worked out some pretty practical laws. We know from the law code of Elipit Ishtar, Ur-Nammu, and, of course, the best known, but not the oldest, is Hammurabi. Now, you see that, how it protected the bride? If she brought a dowry with her, and the law said that, so she would bring something to the marriage, the bride's father would be recompensed, he would pay a dowry. Sometimes it was larger, sometimes it was smaller. But the dowry protected the bride. It kept the groom from simply taking the dowry and then kicking her out. Now, if she also it protected the husband. How? How did the dowry protect the husband? No. How did it protect him? Note this, she could take the dowry back with her, which would be almost a year's wages, only if she had been faithful to him. If she had been unfaithful to him, he kept the dowry. He could kick her out and keep the dowry. So it protected her. Note this, and it protected the family. This is interesting. The Babylonians knew this. They did not have a divine revelation like the Jews did, but they knew this. And the ancients... Remember, we talked. This is a very important point, that the ancients learned the hard way that if the home were not held sacred or sacrosanct, then society disintegrated. You could not keep the civil order. Everything fell apart. That's one of the reasons why I'm so alarmed about so many things today attacking the home. Pornography attacks the home. Playboy philosophy attacks the home. Abortion attacks the home. Adultery certainly attacks the home. Statism attacks the home. All kinds of things. Homosexuality is a bitter attack on the home. Well, they learned that they needed to keep the home together. And so what this did, it caused a man to... He could not just bring a girl in, take her, use her, take her dowry, and kick her out. Protected her. You see how it encouraged fidelity in the home, at least on her part. She would be encouraged to remain faithful because as long as she was faithful to him, then he could not kick her out without losing the dowry. And intended to protect the home, give it stability. Now, he got didn't say that he had to be faithful. It wasn't fair, it wasn't balanced. But the ancient world was like that. And most of it has always been that way. You understand that? It was a very interesting arrangement. Well, we look at Egypt briefly. There was no evidence of betrothals or of a bride price as such from ancient Egypt. There was, we don't know about it. Now, we don't have as much information from ancient Egypt as we have from ancient Babylonia. Yes? Question. Is this a good question? Or?
I was just wondering, how were they sure that somebody was a lion?
Well, they had a very good... the woman, you mean? If she was faithful?
Couldn't he, if he wanted the money,
couldn't
he buy it off the wife?
Yeah.
1 year's work
wouldn't
important a woman, so he could do that.
You see what she's asking? Yeah, a very good way to do it. If a woman were accused of adultery, they would take her down to the special place in the river, a testing place with all the crocodiles, and they'd throw her in. If she got out alive, she was innocent. If the crocodiles got her, she was guilty. Crocodiles liked it. now that's if she were not caught in the act. If he had witnesses,
if he had witnesses that she was unfaithful, then he could just send her home and keep the dowry. But if he accused her and there were no witnesses, and she said she was innocent, that's how they would test her. Which means, if you're going to play around, learn how to swim.
How can women protect themselves from reliance if their husband was just a bad person?
They did. Well, ultimately they had no protection. But ultimately, well, there was not, the protection would break down, and often did. It's one of the reasons they had such strict laws against bearing false testimony.
Did they have any kind of, what would happen to the man if she came strolling out of the water? Did he have to pay a penalty for false accusation?
I don't know. I don't think so. He just try again later.
One of these days he's back.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. But anyway, we... That's how they would do it. Which seems, it's called trial by ordeal. At least they did that in the earlier period. They didn't do it all through the Mesopotamian period. Are there any other silly questions? Any other questions? Well, that's a good question.
What happens if the man was, fooling
around? The man was fooling around? He was considered normal. By the way, that was interesting. That showed the question was, what if the man was unfaithful? That showed the moral superiority of the law of Moses over its contemporaries. The law of Moses was, thou shalt not commit adultery, period. The old codes had been, you should not commit adultery, women. But the law of Moses said nobody can.
What did he do with the dowry the whole time they were married?
It was his to control.
So he could use it, and then if she found reason that she could leave him, she left him, she got the dowry, he'd in essence be making payments like today, paying alimony.
No, if she were faithful to him, then she couldn't leave him. She couldn't just leave. She could leave, but leave the dowry. She just wanted to go back to her father. But she couldn't take the dowry with her. He couldn't just send her away unless she'd been unfaithful.
She said that in case of divorce, she would like what situation?
Yeah, well, in other words, if he decided he wanted another woman and he wanted to get rid of her, then, and she had not been unfaithful, he could send her away.
But he just
lost all that money. It was worth it to him to lose all that money.
What if he'd spent the dowry by that?
Well, he still owed it.
He would have to make
it. Yeah, and if he'd spent it, he couldn't send her back. In other words, if she were innocent, was not guilty of adultery, and he wanted another woman, he wanted to get rid of her, he was going to pay the price. And he had to make sure he could pay it, or he had to keep her. So it did give some stability to it. I've got to catch a plane, so we're going to stop.